Welcome to Pop Pantheon, the podcast where we completely overanalyze all of your favorite pop stars and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon. This is your host, DJ Louis XIV, reminding you to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it now. Follow us on social media at Pop Pantheon Pod, merch at poppantheonpod.com, Patreon, where we do weekly bonus episodes of this show, patreon.com/poppantheon, or you can subscribe for the audio only directly in the Apple Podcasts app. Okay, gorgeous. My queer pop party is happening this weekend in Los Angeles at Los Globos. This is on Saturday night, April 20th, and it is happening on Friday, May 10th at the Sultan Room in Bushwick. Tickets for both of those is available in the show notes of this episode. Most importantly, though, tomorrow night is Pop Pantheon Presents Taylor Mania. This is our dance party. I'm going to be DJing Taylor all night on the day of the release of her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, which comes out tonight. So get in there, buy your tickets, come see me at Parkside Lounge in the East Village in New York for Taylor Mania. We'd love to see you there. Russ will also be in town. Come dance to Taylor with us. Come celebrate the album before our live show, which is also happening on Monday, which is sold out at the Bell House. So a lot of Taylor stuff going on this week. Come to the dance party if you don't already have tickets. All right, so we're taking a bit of a left turn this week. This is an episode that's been in the works for a long time, something I've really wanted to cover. I know this is a little bit outside of our normal purview, but I felt like this band spoke to so much about the sound of music in the 1990s and of course released one of the most popular and influential albums of all time. So I felt like it was only fitting for us to do a Pop Pantheon Nirvana. I feel pretty unsure about whether Kurt Cobain would have been happy having his band Nirvana featured on a podcast called Pop Pantheon. Sure, Nirvana unexpectedly made one of the biggest albums of all time with 1991's Nevermind, a record that not only sold 30 million copies and produced one of the defining hits of the decade, briefly remolding the mainstream pop charts and their image with their disaffected growl and pummeling grunge pop anthems. But after this deep dive, I'm struck by how Kurt seems defined by his dualities, someone caught between his instincts for unflinching authenticity and massive recognition. A strange dyad that made his music so compelling, pulsing with resolute emotional honesty and massive accessibility. He at once aspired for embrace and was defined by his integrity, which bristled at the mainstream capitalistic ideas his success traded in. He was a fearless iconoclast in his music, often abrasively screaming his way through songs that excavated his deepest, darkest pain and even openly chastised his own audience, and at the same time had one of the greatest knacks of the period for pop hooks and melody. He seemed custom-made to become the quote-unquote voice of a generation and clearly despised that tag. Kurt and Nirvana were not necessarily pop stars, and yet they were, for a brief moment, the most popular act on the planet, setting the agenda for music and culture, whether they liked it or not. And since Kurt is no longer with us, who can say? But for all these reasons, I believe Kurt and Nirvana, outsiders who came to define a moment of pop music history, are absolutely integral to the pop pantheon. Kurt Cobain was born in Aberdeen, a small harbor town just off the coast of the Pacific Ocean, less than a two-hour drive from Seattle. His mother was a waitress and his father a mechanic, though they divorced when he was just eight. Family members have said that Kurt, who obsessively listened to the Beatles as a child, began singing at age two and learned to play the piano at four. Kurt's dad bought him an electric guitar for his 14th birthday, and he learned to play Led Zeppelin in the cars. As a teenager, Kurt was immersed in the punk scene, which was thriving in the Pacific Northwest at the time. At high school, he met a bassist named Chris Novoselic, and the pair decided to start a band, cycling through both a rotating cast of drummers and a series of names from Skid Row to Pen Cap Chew, Bliss, and Ted Ed Fred before making their debut as Nirvana at a show in Tacoma in the spring of 1988, a few weeks before recording their first demos. Later that year, they released an off-kilter cover of a 1969 song by the Dutch rock band Shocking Blue, Love Buzz, on a new independent label based out of Seattle called Sub Pop that was heavily involved in the emerging local grunge scene. A sound pioneered by a band Kurt and Chris idolized from nearby Montesano called The Melvins. Only 1,000 copies of that vinyl were pressed, but the single earned the band positive reviews and notices, especially from the UK press. Recorded in Seattle over just 6 days and for only $600, Nirvana's debut album, 1989's Bleak Sparse Bleach, only sold 40,000 copies in its initial release, but college radio started to play Nirvana songs and the band became known on the underground and DIY circuit and in the UK. After the album's release, Nirvana toured, released a new EP, Blue, in the UK, and opened for Sonic Youth on tour. We'll be right back. In 1990, Nirvana set to work on new material, but were frustrated by Sub Pop's lack of promotion and distribution and sought out a major label to buy them out of their contract, ultimately signing to the Geffen imprint DGC in 1990. Joined by yet another new drummer, Dave Grohl, who'd been in the Washington hardcore band Scream from the age of 17, the band began to refine what would become 1991's Nevermind. The story of the creation of this record is music industry legend, a classic push-pull between then-prevalent ideas of realness and quote-unquote selling out. These songs were at once abrasive and massively pop chorus oriented. They were mixed and remixed, toggling between something more rugged and shiny radio fodder. Curtain Crew, along with their labels and collaborators like producer Butch Vig, seemed at war with each other and internally about just how radio-friendly to make these brutally honest and emotionally stirring, but ultimately indelibly hooky records. The lead single, the cathartic, confrontational rager Smells Like Teen Spirit, was pop by design. Kurt said he was, quote, trying to write the ultimate pop song. Initially, the song didn't chart, but it sold well in parts of the US in which the band had already established a fan base, and its music video soon entered heavy rotation on MTV and became an unexpected hit, landing at number 6 on the Hot 100 and earning platinum certification. Smells Like Teen Spirit was more than just a smash song. It, along with its spooky video, which takes place in the most demonic-seeming pep rally in history, ignited an entire generation of disaffected teens who were fed up with shiny radio pop and were clearly in search of a place to channel their rage against the machine. Nevermind exploded from there, becoming a phenomenon as it rocketed from its number 144 debut in September 1991 to replacing Michael Jackson's Dangerous at the top of the charts in January of next year. The record went on to become one of the biggest selling albums of all time, moving more than 10 million copies in the US and 30 million worldwide. It's been ranked as one of the best albums of the 90s by Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, and Time, and is frequently credited for popularizing Seattle grunge and mainstreaming alternative rock in the US. The album's follow-up singles didn't quite reach the heights of Smells Like Teen Spirit, but hits like Come As You Are, Lithium, and In Bloom stand today as definitional emblems of alternative rock come pop music of this period. In early 1992, Kurt married Hole frontwoman Courtney Love on the beach in Waikiki, Hawaii. Courtney, already pregnant, wore red lipstick and a satin dress. Kurt wore green pajamas. At the same time, rumors were flying about the couple's drug use. One journalist wrote that Kurt showed up to an interview with sunken cheeks and scabbed, sallow skin, insinuating he'd been using heroin, which Kurt then denied in a Rolling Stone cover story that documented him in bed sick and having not eaten for 2 weeks. A Vanity Fair story about the couple, released 1 month after the birth of their first child, Frances Bean Cobain, in August 1992, meanwhile, reported that Courtney had introduced Kurt to heroin and quoted a friend who claimed she was taking drugs while pregnant. At the tail end of 1992, the band released a compilation of B-sides, demos, outtakes, and covers, Incesticide, that went platinum despite withheld promotion. Nirvana's third album, 1993's Darker and Grittier in Utero, featured an abundance of infant and childbirth imagery, including fetuses surrounded by carnations and lilies on the back cover. Recorded in a small town in Minnesota, the album was led by a love song from Kurt to Courtney called Heart-Shaped Box, though none of the singles were officially pushed in the US to avoid cannibalizing sales of the album. In Utero debuted at number 1, moving 180,000 copies in its first week, and was a massive success, selling more than 5 million copies total, though it was roughly half of Nevermind's domestic haul. Early in 1994, Nirvana embarked on a European tour. In Rome, Courtney found Kurt unconscious in their hotel room and he was rushed to the hospital. Once back in the US, Courtney, Christ, and the band's manager staged an intervention. Courtney then checked into rehab in Beverly Hills, and Kurt soon checked into a separate rehab in Marina Del Rey, though he checked out 2 days later and flew back to Seattle. A week later, on April 8, 1994, Kurt was found dead in his home. A suicide note was found in a nearby flower pot. 7 months after Kurt's passing, Nirvana's MTV Unplugged performance was released as an album. It debuted at number 1, selling more than 310,000 copies, the highest first week sales of Nirvana's career. It quickly outsold In Utero, moving more than 8 million copies in the US. Another live album, a compilation of live performances called From the Muddy Banks of the Wishka, was released in 1996 and received a platinum certification. A self-titled compilation album was released in 2002, 8 years after Kurt's passing, and sold more than 2 million copies. It remains the final major Nirvana release. After Kurt's death, Dave started a new band, the Foo Fighters, and continued to release music to great success. The band has sold 32 million albums and collected 15 Grammy Awards. Christ continued to dabble in music, playing in bands including Sweet 75 and Eyes Adrift, but has focused on activism and politics, penning a political column for Seattle Weekly, writing a book of grunge and government, Let's Fix This Broken Democracy, and campaigning for electoral reform. He is currently the leader of the Forward Party, which is aimed at providing an alternative to American two-party politics for Washington State. Nirvana has sold more than 75 million records worldwide. They have 7 platinum albums, including 2 live albums and 2 compilation records. They have one platinum box set, one platinum single, and one top 10 single. Nirvana received one Grammy Award, five MTV VMA Awards, four NME Awards, one American Music Award, one BMI Pop Award, and one Brit Award. In 2023, the Grammys bestowed the band with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Nirvana was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in their first year of eligibility in 2014. Rolling Stone named Nirvana as one of the 100 greatest artists of all time and named Kurt both one of the 100 greatest singers and 100 greatest guitarists of all time. Here with me to discuss the brief and extraordinary pop centrism of Nirvana is host of the incredible podcast Bandsplain, which returns this week, Yossi Salek. All right, so I'm here with the host of Bandsplain, Yossi Salek. Yossi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's my honor. I'm such a big fan of your show, and I'm so glad to have you here because you know how to bandsplain, and we don't often talk about bands, so we need the bands splained to us. So this is like the source of bandsplaining. I want to kick us off by just introducing this topic because, as I mentioned to you off mic, this is not typically an act that we might think of as traditionally pop.
Yeah.
This isn't a pop star in the traditional sense of the word, but they do represent a moment that feels all too uncommon in the years since them, where a true-to-God rock act for a very fleeting moment became the most important pop act in the world and really set the agenda for a lot of the sound and notions of pop in their moment. I'm curious why you think that happened. I mean, as just a way to get into this conversation a little bit, what was it about Nirvana, particularly as a band in that moment, that allowed a group and a lead singer like Kurt Cobain, who had a lot of both, it seems, ambitions for mainstream success, but also a lot of reluctance about mainstream success, to come together and have this sort of moment of pop centrism? I mean, it's kind of a strange little incident. Looking back, it feels inevitable, you know what I mean? But thinking about it just as an idea, it's strange that this man suddenly became as big of a pop star as he did in that moment. And I'm curious if you have just broad insights into why you think that happened.
I mean, that's like a kind of a huge question.
We're going to get more granular about it as the conversation goes on, but I just think as a way to just talk about it a little bit, what do you think are the main reasons that allowed him to achieve that moment?
We talk about this a lot on Bandsplain, but I think it's a confluence of like 18 different things that had to happen both within that artist's life and career and also broadly more culturally speaking. There's a really great line, I'm going to butcher it because I don't have it in front of me, where like, I think when Kurt died, the Newsweek article about it, which I still have that Newsweek enshrined in a plastic somewhere, it was a big deal for me, but
yes,
it was basically saying that grunge was the sound of children of divorce getting guitars. I bring that up because I think what did happen was divorce started to become extremely prevalent, way more prevalent than it had been. So you'd have, I want to say it's the greatest generation. Don't fucking quote me on that. It's not the boomers because it's the Gen X's parents.
Right.
Who I think was the greatest generation.
Yes.
Divorce starts happening. And this is really rare. And this is earth shattering for young people who are experiencing it. And, you know, you manufacture angst. And there's also like the whole thing of, okay, the dream of the counterculture of the 60s did not happen. And there's all this disillusionment and you like pair all this in. And then the extravagance of the 80s is not really hitting with these kids who are sort of disillusioned. And all of this sort of lines up. Plus there's the meeting of metal and punk
right.
that births this new sound, which we'll get into. I don't count Nirvana as a grunge band.
Okay, a hot take right up top here.
Yeah. And also, interestingly, not to commandeer your show, but it is incredibly telling of what happens when someone's life is cut short and the myth is created.
Yes.
Because Pearl Jam was a much bigger band than Nirvana.
Right.
And no one really talks about this. They outsold Nirvana. They were a bigger, culturally impactful band, more famous.
Right.
But you chose Nirvana, even though all arguments can be made that Pearl Jam was the biggest rock band of the 90s.
Right. It's very interesting. But I think that's true. We've talked about this in the context of Amy Winehouse as well.
Yeah.
The way the mythos can almost grow exponentially when you lose somebody before you feel like you've gotten the totality of what they were going to offer.
Well, yeah. And because they never get the chance to embarrass themselves or to
right.
put out bad music or to diminish their own legacy, which is a right and privilege that people who stay alive
right.
have. Thank God. Good. Stay alive and make fucking some shitty later career records. I'd rather that than like, it's not worth it, but better for worse, that's what happened.
Right. Well, it's an interesting thought experiment because I think one of the defining aspects of the short-lived discography of Nirvana is that push and pull between Kurt's clear pop intuitions and his desire to quote-unquote not sell out,
totally.
Which I think is a really kind of like dead concept in our contemporary culture.
Does your audience know about this term?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like the notions of selling out are something that we've kind of left by the wayside. I think for the best in most instances, you know, I think that that's really interesting to see a group reflect this notion of like how much it was creating grist internally with them about how much their success was sort of bastardizing what they wanted or what they wanted to make or whatever that was. And yet at the same time, it's so obvious that Kurt had so much skill as a centrist hook maker.
Yeah.
He was such a good pop artist, you know, and it's really interesting as a thought experiment to think about what would have happened in the sort of ping-ponging effect between those two impulses of his mm-hmm. to remain quote-unquote credible, but also play towards obvious talents he had towards creating incredibly hooky music. I mean, in spite of how much this music can sometimes be abrasive, it's usually, especially on Nevermind, which is obviously the record of Nirvana records for most people,
right.
It's one of the hookiest records you could imagine. Like you strip back some of the window dressing on it and you're dealing with incredibly chorus driven pop music. So I think that would have been really interesting. The other thing that I wanted to point out just about the moment is I always think about, and again, I know you're not characterizing Nirvana as a grunge band, but let's just for all intents and purposes in a broad sense, put them in that bucket for 1 second. I always think about the rise of grunge and the rise of gangster rap happening in tandem, both sort of taking hold of popular music as very related. There's clearly a moment here of rage and disaffection in youth culture from numerous angles across numerous racial groups and socioeconomic groups that is incredibly definitional to Gen X at this exact moment that sort of allows this backlash against the ideas of major label studio produced pop music. And it allows people like Tupac and people like Kurt Cobain, you know, who are different artists but are channeling rage in similar ways, I feel like, to really become bigger pop stars in some ways than the more traditional pop stars that we had become used to in the 80s in this sort of fleeting moment. It only lasted for a second. It's also funny to think of all this happening in tandem to like Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston, but
yeah.
It's just an interesting, clear moment of harnessing of certain feeling of disaffection. And I'm curious, in your mind, that disaffection is just the product of divorce. Are there other things that feel important to like understanding what they're harnessing here exactly in this moment?
I was a little young, yes. Right? I was maybe 10, 11 around this time.
Yes.
But I remember being a rage-filled preteen.
Right.
And I think most teenagers have that, right? And
yes.
Maybe like the music hadn't spoken to them.
Right.
But then culturally, like what's going on? The Gulf War.
Right.
I think there's just a lot that is feeling like it's not connecting. I think a lot of teens around the country are like, yeah, I don't get Motley Crue.
Right.
That doesn't speak to me. And also like there's economic situations that they're living in like beat down towns where the industry has died off and there's not money. The 80s was all about like living large and extravagance and that's not connecting. So I don't know. I think there was a lot of things that sort of led to that moment.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So let's go back and talk about this in a little more detail. What I want to ask you is just for some light background on the band, specifically on the founding members to begin with, Kurt Cobain and Chris. Who are these guys? What are their early lives like? And I guess most importantly for this story, what are the elements of their upbringings that help us understand who they are as musicians and stars?
Totally. I mean, I think a little bit less is known about Chris Novoselic's upbringing and background because he wasn't really the focus of a lot of biographies or stories and he didn't do as many interviews, but maybe you can extrapolate. Chris, his parents are Yugoslavian,
mm-hmm.
but they're both from Aberdeen, Washington, which is this small town, like 100 miles from Seattle. It was like a logging town that had sort of fallen on hard times. And it's, for lack of a better, it's redneck. You know, it's like a redneck town with like a bunch of macho, homophobic, right-wing type people. And they both, again, are children of divorce. Kurt, in particular, had like a pretty fraught upbringing between his dad that he didn't get along with and his mom, who he loved, but she had several different boyfriends and husbands that were varying levels of terrible.
Yes.
He was an alienated little kid and teenager. You know, I think there's a sense of like, Is this all there is? How do we get out of here? You talked about ambition, right? I think first ambition comes from like, I can't stay here.
Yes.
What's the way out of here?
Right. And also from my understanding of it, he witnessed like a ton of domestic abuse between his parents.
Yeah.
And was also kicked out of his house. He was kind of ping-ponging back and forth between the two of them.
Yeah. They couldn't deal with him.
Right. And for a period of time was living with like a born-again Christian family. I mean, one of the most interesting parts of Nirvana's music is the way that Kurt relates to religion, and he becomes super religious living with this born-again Christian family, and then obviously becoming kind of disillusioned with it. So I thought that that was a couple of interesting little moments, considering that there's elements of his fraught relationship to God that feel like they permeate songs like Lithium and stuff like that.
100%. And just fraught relationship with masculinity.
Yes.
This is another part of my, like, I have a broader theory about this divorce thing, because I think about it a lot. I think it was a huge crisis for men in particular. Young men were affected particularly badly by it. I can't really explain why, and I have to get back to my lab on that one, but it does seem that it created a lot of feminists. You know, it created a lot of men with a real sour taste in their mouth about masculinity because their masculine role model left or was out of the picture or didn't support them, and they side with their mothers, and that lends itself to a lot of the music of the early 90s. You have it with Eddie Vedder, you have it with Kurt Cobain, you have it with these men who, they have a different approach, right?
Yes, absolutely. And he tells the story about befriending a gay kid in his high school and everybody calling him gay and kind of coming to the defense of this kid as being like a real formative part of his upbringing.
Yeah, they were like best friends. And I think the guy like finally like admitted to him that he was gay. And Kurt was like, I don't care, I love you anyways. But actually, ultimately, he did kind of reject him because they were getting bullied.
Right.
Like, really badly. And he was like, I'm really sorry. I just like can't be your friend anymore. And the guy was like, I understand.
Yeah.
That's how it was, you know?
But really interesting. I mean, I grew up in the late 90s and early 2000s as a gay kid, and it was bad in many ways. And there was not a lot of straight guys that were coming to my rescue or befriending me. So the fact that he was doing that is a radical act in this time period.
Oh my God, in the 80s in Aberdeen, Washington, 100%.
Yes.
So yeah, so him and Chris met in high school. And Kurt moved, like you said, moved around a lot, went to a couple of high schools, but they met at Aberdeen High through the Melvins.
Right.
And the Melvins are a really important part of Nirvana's story.
What is the music scene that is informative to Kurt? Because Kurt begins making and playing music at a young age and is kind of obsessed with the Beatles. And in speaking of our pop context here, one of his formative early memories also, I think, was drawing a caricature of Michael Jackson, like as part of a course that he was in when he was in middle school or something like that.
Yeah, because he was an artist. Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the music that is informative to Kurt's foundation as a musician?
For sure. So you mentioned the Beatles. I think that was a really early influence. And then later, I mean, this is the 80s, the 70s, 80s. Everyone was into Kiss.
Right.
Kiss is a band that radicalizes a lot of alternative rock musicians because they were, I think, in their own way, the most alternative of the mainstream big rock musicians.
Interesting.
Because they were weird and the makeup.
A little queer, Kiss.
Exactly, a little queer.
Yeah.
There's a great story that his dad had joined the Columbia Music Tape Club. I'm deeply obsessed with Columbia. You're a little young to have dealt with this. By the time I had it, it was CDs, but it was the best thing in the entire world. But you would send off, and it was like a subscription service. They would send you all these tapes. He got into a bunch of music that way. Particularly important because in Aberdeen, Washington, you couldn't find a Black Sabbath tape at a record store, if there was even a record store.
Right.
So this exposure is a big deal.
Right.
But everyone's into metal. It's the 80s. The guys in the school are into metal, and he's into metal too, until a couple of things happen. He sees the B-52s on Saturday Night Live in 1980. That's a big deal. This is a new wave weirdo band. And he's like, wow, that's fucking cool, you know? And then he learns about the Sex Pistols, and I love this because I think it's so interesting, through Cream magazine, but can't hear the music. So he like kind of learns about punk first through imagery. Even the imagery like was so out there and weird, and to someone who felt out there and weird, it spoke to him, I guess. But then it's Buzz Osborne from the Melvins who puts him on to like Black Flag and Flipper and actual California punk music. And I think that sort of like blows his brain.
What is it about that music? Like, how would you describe what the Melvins are? And for people even like me, I mean, I've listened to the Melvins passingly just in prepping for this episode, but it's not something that's secondhand language to me.
The Melvins is like expert level for the pop audience.
I'm saying, so like, how would you describe what this act is, and why do you think they speak so directly to Kurt?
The Melvins were, again, just fucking weird, man. Like, they started by playing covers, I think, of The Who and Jimi Hendrix and whatever, but they liked metal and they loved punk and they liked to slow shit down just to be weird. They sort of invented this thing, I think, called sludge metal, which is slow, heavy. They were provocateurs, basically, but they were also teenagers. The main, I think, importance is that Kurt had never seen anyone make a band. Like, he was like, oh, you can just make a band? Wow, this is huge. He was really enamored by them because they just did it. They made a band. They would play behind the fucking Thriftway or whatever where Buzz Osborne worked. And he was like, oh, maybe I can make a band too.
He seems drawn to both people that are twisting the formula and are strange, out there, whatever, but then also seems drawn to acts like the Beatles or the B-52s or acts that are clearly pop-oriented in many ways. I mean, no more formative pop-oriented group than the Beatles, who are clearly big heroes of his.
Yeah, and that's the central core thing of Nirvana, which we will obviously get into, and you kind of talked about at the top of the episode, is that, like, stripped away, those are pop songs.
Exactly.
That's what Kurt writes.
Right.
They might be produced in a different way or sound in a different way, which is why I don't think that Nirvana is a grunge band.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, this is obviously now going to be a core conflict in our story here, but they're viewed as part of the grunge movement or the popularization of this movement. So I feel like it's important for us, even if you're going to say that they're not this, to like lay out what that is. What is grunge, and like, how does that exist pre-Kurt? And also, I think that that leads to another important conversation that maybe is part of this too, which is another thing that isn't as big of a deal these days, but was such a huge part of this period of music, which is regional music scenes. I mean, this is just such a huge part of music listening culture in this time period that we just don't think about that much anymore, especially as pop listeners. It's less regional. But can you just talk about what grunge is as a movement, whether or not Nirvana fits perfectly into it? I feel like that's important groundwork for this.
Totally. At this time, nobody cared about Seattle. Nobody cared about music that came from Seattle. Nobody cared. Seattle did have a music scene. It was sort of punk adjacent. There was the U-Men, this band Skin Yard, Green River, which is, in my opinion, the first grunge band. To simplify it, perhaps oversimplify it, it really was this sort of meeting of the kids that were like, I love metal and I love punk. Without thoroughly thinking that through, this is this new thing that fuses these two things. That's the vibe that we're going for. Early on, Green River, like I mentioned, which was Mark Arm and the two dudes who later on became Pearl Jam, Stone Gossard, and Jeff Ament. This is like early 80s. And what really cemented this whole thing as big capital G grunge was Sub Pop. Really, Sub Pop had this brilliant, kind of honestly sinister marketing approach. There's this guy, Jack Endino, from the band Skin Yard. He recorded everybody. That's why it all sounds like that, because he was like, I only knew how to record my own shitty guitar, and so I recorded everyone else's guitar in that same shitty way. That's why it all kind of has this thick grunge sound that people talk about. Even the word grunge came originally from Mark Arm, who used it as like an adjective when he was talking about his own band in a letter to the editor, to The Rocket, I think, and then was co-opted by Sub Pop, who used it to describe Green River.
Interesting.
Anyways, fast forward, Sub Pop is trying to like get off the ground, and they put out the Green River EP, they put out the Soundgarden EP, they are about to put out Nirvana's single. They fly over a Melody Maker writer named Everett True, and they're like, hey, we have these cool bands here, you should see them. And they're big thing was they wanted to present them as, I don't want to say white trash, but kind of. Like, their whole thing was, isn't it crazy? These bands are from the sticks. Because they had this other band called Tad, whose main guy was this guy, Tad Doyle. This big fat guy wore, like, flannels and stuff. And they were like, oh, this uneducated butcher, and kind of painted Nirvana the same way as these. Meanwhile, like, Tad Doyle was totally college educated. It was like a trained jazz drummer. Right. Kurt Cobain was brilliant. They were just like, they liked this narrative. And the guy from Melody Maker like came and was like, yeah, it's crazy. These bands are white trash, but they're so good. And it's a scene. And they kind of just manufactured a scene of grunge. And it took off from there.
Wasn't a big aspect of it the just sort of introspective social alienation, self-doubt, anxiety, abuse, the themes of it, this sort of downward gaze, low simmering, inward facing anger that was part of the scene and part of the culture of grunge?
I guess. I mean, the Melvins are kind of way more lighthearted than that in their thematics. Soundgarden was, yeah, a little angry, but I think that came later. I think the application of that comes with Pearl Jam and Nirvana, because those were sort of the two, but they're predated by Alice in Chains, by Soundgarden, by Green River, by Mother Love Bone, who wasn't a grunge band, but is important because they were one of those bands in the scene, and they got signed to a major very early on with like a huge deal.
Right. Okay, so back to Nirvana. So Kurt Cobain comes up, he's obsessed with music, he gets a guitar when he's 14, he learns to play like a bunch of pop songs on the guitar. I was reading Stairway to Heaven and Queen and whatever.
And Louie Louie, most importantly Louie Louie.
Louie Louie, especially to me.
And Smells Like Teen Spirit, the same chord progression.
Right, exactly. So in 1985, he formed his first band, which is called Fecal Matter, Charming.
Correct.
And then basically he gets into high school and meets Chris, and they decide to start a band together, or he decides to bring him into Fecal Matter. I don't know.
Yeah, Fecal Matter just doesn't gel because the other members are like at different points, different members of the Melvins. Right. They're not serious about it. He gets kind of frustrated because he wants it to be a real thing, and he just kind of abandons it, and he likes Chris and is like, we can do this together. Let's do a band.
Right. And their first band is like a Creedence Clearwater Revival tribute band. Did you?
Is that true? Yeah. I didn't know that. I believe you, but I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then basically I was reading that they settle on the name Nirvana because he wanted it to be like a more beautiful name.
Yeah. They were called Skid Row. They had all these different names before they settled on Nirvana.
Right. What do you think is Kurt and Chris shared either ambition or musical aesthetic? What do you think that they see in each other that makes them gel as a duo?
I mean, I have to just assume they were both in this Melvin scene, and to find even one other person who actually has musical talent who likes this absolute outsider weirdo shit that you do, it was probably enough.
Right.
Again, I'm simply speculating. That is what I would guess.
Right.
And they had a chemistry and they had a vision.
Right. So how does their musical career actually begin? Because obviously you mentioned Sub Pop earlier. Sub Pop is a label in Seattle, like an independent record label that ends up releasing their first single, which is a cover of Love Buzz by Shocking Blue. How does that all happen?
So TLDR, they basically start playing shows in Tacoma, Olympia, these sort of small shows. They play a radio show on the Olympia radio station, Chaos, which I think Bruce Pavitt was at some point a DJ on. But they record a demo with Jack Endino, who I mentioned earlier, who was the guy who was recording everybody. Mm-hmm. He recorded Green River, he recorded the Melvins for this compilation. And so they wanted to record with him. Jack Endino gave the demo to Jonathan Poneman of Sub Pop. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan Poneman was like, this is amazing. Bruce Pavitt was like, this sucks. He's like, this is too metal. I don't like it. And he's said that in various different words.
Right.
They go and see them play. Bruce Pavitt is still not convinced, but that's when he like sparks the idea where he's like, we have Tad. These guys are from Aberdeen. White trash. Seattle was very insular. They were very like, you don't go here. And there was a great story where Jonathan Poneman was so excited and went and played the demo. They all worked at Muzak, the headquarters of the makes the elevator music.
Yeah.
Mark Arm, Bruce Pavitt, Tad. And he was like, listen to this. And they were all like, I don't know, it's mid. They didn't care. But anyways, Bruce Pavitt sees the vision of like, now I can sell the white trash musicians to the world, and they decide to put out that single. And so they do. It takes forever to come out because Sub Pop had no money.
Right.
Sub Pop tried to borrow money from Kurt Cobain to put the single out. And Kurt Cobain was like, no, go away.
What does the single say about this band at this time? How would you describe this cover? What are the facets of this song that help us understand Nirvana in this early phase to you? They take this song from 1969 and basically just scream their way through it, is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. I can't know because, like, of course, I didn't experience it in real time, but it's very catchy. But it also, I think off bat, the first thing you notice is that Kurt Cobain has an incredible voice.
Yes.
His voice is just so singular. And you really hear it even in the cover of Love Buzz. And it's heavy and aggressive, but it was wise. I don't think it was Nirvana's idea. I don't think they wanted to do that as a single. I think Sub Pop pushed for it. But it's also poppy, right? Because it's a pop song, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. That's what I think is one of the most interesting parts about it, is we were talking about Nirvana songs being pop songs dressed up as not pop songs. And I think it's interesting for them to, like, pick a song from a pop record from 1969 and cover it in this manner feels like an interesting patient zero for that formula, in a sense.
Totally.
When you say Kurt's voice is so amazing, what is so striking about it? I think of it so much as a vessel for pain and how much he can convey that in such a powerful way. Like, are there other aspects of that that feel important to note?
I think you have that down for sure. It has a vulnerability, but it also is just this gravelly uniqueness. Even metal bands, there was some sort of beauty to the voice of these men singing. Axl Rose has a beautiful voice, you know. Ugly is not the right word, but abrasive maybe is the right word. And you didn't hear that, I don't think, in the greater mainstream rock bands before this.
Interesting. So how does that all lead them to eventually record and release Bleach? And we need to talk about the drummer. Who was the original drummer?
The Spinal Tap situation?
Yes.
I mean, babe, I don't know, take your pick. There's so many drummers. Nobody here cares, so I'm just gonna skip to the one that plays on Bleach.
Yes, that's what I'm wondering.
The guy Chad Channing
right.
is the guy that plays on Bleach. I really don't know where Chad Channing came from.
Yeah, but he's there.
He's there. He ends up playing on the Love Buzz single and the Bleach album. They also get this guy who joins the band named Jason Everman, who does not play on the Bleach album, but pays for its recording, $660.
Right.
So he is credited on it. And he does play in Nirvana briefly on one tour as their, like, second guitarist. But then he's fired.
So what is this album? How would you describe this? I mean, this is a markedly different sounding record to me than Nevermind is. What do you think their goal is with this music? And how would you describe the music on this record, either in ways that it's similar to the Love Buzz single or different?
I think Bleach has a lot of the DNA of Nevermind. It's just produced particularly grungy. And I think that was by design, obviously. I think Kurt's said in interviews they were pushed towards this grunge sound and to fit in with the other grunge bands on the label, and Dino's recording it. But About a Girl is a pop song.
Yes, almost Beatles-esque.
Yeah. Negative Creep is pretty poppy. Blue is pretty poppy.
Mm-hmm.
They're just produced in this sort of different way. And it's fucking good, man. Blue is really funny. The first song, I feel like it really grabs you. And I guess they're like, we're going to do drop D tuning, which is classic grunge. Every grunge is in drop D tuning. But they didn't realize that they were already in drop D tuning and they dropped it down another. And so it's extremely heavy sounding. Mainly what's important is they were pushed towards grunge, and also he hadn't heard the Pixies yet, because the Pixies, Surfer Rosa comes out that same year after they record. The Pixies, Surfer Rosa has a massive impact on Kurt's songwriting. Not that he wasn't already writing songs like that, because he says he was, but he basically heard it and was like, oh, you can put those out. I'd never heard people that were like punk able to do things this poppy. And famously, the Pixies' whole thing was they sort of invented this quiet, loud,
right.
which became Nirvana's also trademark. And that was really inspiring to him. So that's a main thing that changes between Bleach and Nevermind.
Right. We'll be right back. I want to come back to that in a second, because I do think that's really interesting. One thing I just wanted to ask you about Bleach is, what are these songs about? What does Kurt write about? I mean, one thing that I was trying to parse apart as I was listening to these songs is, are they attitude songs? I've read that he has said in the past that lyrics kind of were secondary to him in a sense. Yeah. They were about an emotional feeling or about an attitude more so than they were about anything at all. Does that clock for you as true about these songs?
About Bleach, for sure. I think so.
Yeah.
When you listen, the words are good. They're lyrically good, but they don't have the depth of meaning that I think that you end up finding in Nevermind.
Right. And even in Nevermind, there's a lot of nonsense lyrics that sometimes don't make any sense.
Yeah.
But I feel like the number one thing that sort of registers for me in listening to this music is just the anger. Like, Negative Creep to me, like, is almost terrifying to listen to. Like, he's gonna burst his larynx open or something like that. Just rageful. It's moving in a way that's scary in some ways when I listen to this record. It like kind of freaked me out.
Yeah, I mean, like, he heard Henry Rollins in Black Flag,
yeah,
who has this rage coming out in the same tone, and he heard Flipper and he felt the anger, and what a great place to fucking put it, you know?
Yeah.
Negative Creep, I think, is about himself.
Mm, like a menace. I don't know. It's disconcerting in certain points, and I mean that as a compliment. And also a sense of sarcasm and cynicism feels like an important part of this as well.
And nihilism. Yeah, totally.
Nihilism. Yes. Which also feels definitional to Gen X in this period for whatever reason. That disaffection that often gets pegged. All right. So I want to return to the Surfer Rosa thing in one second. I also want to talk about, how does this record perform? How does this record establish Nirvana? If it does, what are the sort of effects of this? Not commercially, because obviously this doesn't turn them into like international superstars, but how does this album affect their commercial trajectory? Where does it establish them?
Right. Well, you kind of have to remember that, again, this is like no one is checking for this stuff
right
at this time. But Bleach sells really well for Sub Pop. Even though Sub Pop completely fumbles the marketing and distribution of it, it keeps selling. And I think the fumbling of the marketing and distribution is a big reason for Nirvana being like, we're not coming back to you. But, and we'll get into that.
Right.
We can't even get into how Nirvana saved Sub Pop. But they tour a bunch,
right,
and it picks up with touring. But also, it's word of mouth. Mm. People start passing it around. The English thing is big. These bands start getting a foothold in England through this Melody Maker article and John Peel and all this stuff before they even are taken more seriously here in America. And it is a classic organic spread. People are just like, this is good, this is good. And it gets passed around and it gets bought and bought and bought to the point that it's not even distributed well enough. It could have sold more, but Sub Pop couldn't get it together.
Are there other bands in this scene that are more commercially successful than Nirvana before Nevermind? They're having like more crossover success?
100%. Soundgarden and Alice in Chains were signed to majors way before this.
So are they softening the ground for Nevermind with more pop audiences, do you think?
100%. I mean, Alice in Chains. So Man in the Box is the first of these singles that makes it to radio. And that also softens the thing for Nevermind, because prior to this, they don't really know where to put these bands. Does it go on metal radio? Does it go on hard rock radio? Alternative radio in the late 80s was Depeche Mode.
Right.
Was The Cure.
Right.
Was 10,000 Maniacs. It was not anything like this. So they were like, well, it doesn't go there.
Mm.
So after 9 months of Man in the Box being out, they finally found it a place on radio. And I think that also really helped open the door. Also, don't forget, Sonic Youth was already signed to Geffen. There's a precedent.
And like, Kurt has massive star quality. I mean, he is incredibly handsome, even though like he's trying to obscure it and look grungy, so to speak, not to be reductive about it.
Yeah.
Kurt is a superstar. He has that going on.
It's funny. Funny, like, all that you read says the same thing, which is that in person, he was, like, dirty looking and, like, diminutive and, like, skinny. And
yeah.
I'm sure he was, like, handsome or whatever.
Yeah.
But he just photographed and videoed incredibly well.
Yeah.
He has the bone structure. I like to say that he has a thing called negative charisma, which lends itself a lot to the genre, too, which it's almost repellent because he so clearly doesn't want you to look at him. But then it's so captivating that you can't help but look at him. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Which is different than someone who's just the normal frontman charisma, who's like, hey, look at me, you know?
Yes, 100%. He's not doing Mick Jagger or whatever, but he's sexy. I mean, he really is. He has massive sex appeal.
100%.
It's overwhelming in certain instances.
I think it's because it's also, he was so authentic.
Yes, exactly.
I hate to say that word, but like,
no, it's true. It's true.
It was so refreshing for people to see this confrontational, but completely, you got the sense, honest person.
For sure.
Must have just been like you couldn't take your eyes off of them.
Yes. I mean, obsessed with integrity.
Yeah.
Really, really, really obsessed with it. It's funny because you don't often get people that achieve this level of fame with that level of devotion to integrity.
Eddie Vedder also. Very similar.
Yeah. All right. So how do we then move into this period where Nirvana basically levels up? How do we get to this moment where they're like, we need to go bigger?
Okay. So famously, one night, Chris Novoselic came to, I don't remember if it was Jonathan Palmer or Bruce Pavitt's house, and was like, we need a contract. Sub Pop did not have contracts with their artists. Nobody had a contract.
Right.
And I think they were like, well, you're not doing right by us. We need a contract, thinking that it would help them in the end. And Sub Pop was like, okay, we'll figure it out. Meanwhile, that piece of fucking paper is why Sub Pop is still a label, because they literally would have gone bankrupt. Nevermind is what saved Sub Pop from bankruptcy. But that's getting a little ahead. Anyways, they're starting to pick up steam, starting to have attention. Susan Silver managed Soundgarden and was Chris Cornell's girlfriend. I can't remember if it's Soundgarden or Alice in Chains. Around the same time, both got major label deals. So they were the first of the kids, you know, first of the pack
right.
to get signed. And Susan Silver, obviously Nirvana's in the scene, and Susan Silver was like, she introduced them to their lawyer. Mm. And their lawyer, who is this kind of big time, I don't know his name, Alan Mintz, I think.
Yes.
He starts shopping them. Alan Mintz had gotten the deals for Jane's Addiction, arguably one of the first. There's like four of the first alternative rock bands that made alternative rock. Don't get me started on this. I'll go off on 10 tangents, but Jane's Addiction, obviously one of them. And Faith No More. So he starts getting the labels bidding. And that takes off. People start being like, wait, this is a thing? We need to get it. We need to get it. And the rest is history.
And that's just a product of some of these bands becoming popular and labels looking for other versions of Soundgarden and or Kirch and this band's particular offering, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the 90s is the time where the labels had the most money.
Right.
And they were able to take risks.
Yes.
Nobody thought Nirvana was going to make a bunch of money. But they were just like, cool, we want that one. A&M has a Soundgarden. Capitol or Columbia has an Alice in Chains. We want a Nirvana.
Right.
It wasn't like Nirvana's gonna fucking be number one on the charts. It was just like, why not? Let's get that one. I mean, they had signed Sonic Youth, who, love and respect, had not made them $1 probably. But they're like, we're collecting these. It's fine. It's Pokemon. It doesn't matter. We have a bunch of fucking money because CDs have been invented.
It's like cool factor or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like how like tech companies are like, we're gonna hire people just so the other tech company can't, but we don't even need them. It's yeah. Fucking politics, art of war. I don't know.
I get it. It's hard for us to think about record labels casually spending money, but that is how it was in this time period.
Literally. The amount of bands that these labels signed that you never have heard of in your life.
Right.
That got six-figure, seven-figure deals. Thousands.
All right. Let's talk about Butch Vig, who comes in to produce this record. Now, I think this is a really important moment because this is getting into what we were talking about Kurt's competing intuitive nature regarding his devotion to his integrity and then his desire to become huge.
He always wanted to be successful. He always had ambition. People love to get that twisted and be like, oh my God, poor thing. It's just like he tripped and fell into a major label deal and what a tragedy that right. it ruined him. And it's like, way to take away his agency.
Sure.
He wanted that.
Yes.
And you grow up in the fucking asshole of Aberdeen. It's totally fine to want success. I think it's the same with Pearl Jam. It's the same with a lot of these other bands. It never occurred to them it would be at that level.
Right.
They wanted success, as in a label deal and money and like, I can leave fucking Aberdeen. But it never even crossed anyone's mind that you would be the most famous pop star in the world for a couple of years, you know?
Right. What is Butch Vig? Who is he? And what does that speak to in the context of that conversation? Because I know that, as we'll learn later, Kurt is obsessed with the Pixies record, which is produced by Steve Albini, who he ends up working with on the next record, who would have made a very different sounding album than this.
Yeah.
So like, what does Butch Vig speak to about what their ambitions are for this second album, do you think?
So they're not signed yet
right.
when they go to make this album with Butch Vig.
Right.
Ostensibly, as far as everyone is concerned, they're making this for Sub Pop.
Right.
But what they really do is use it to make demos, and those are the demos they shop.
Right.
Butch Vig had produced an album by Tad called Eight Way Santa, and Nirvana was very close to Tad. But more importantly, he had produced albums by this band Killdozer, this Midwestern band, which Kurt really loved, particularly this one album called 12 Point Buck that was extremely heavy sounding. He was like, I want us to sound that heavy. I want to get that guy.
Mm.
And that's why they got Butch Vig. there's the crunchiness of the guitars, this thick guitar crunchiness. And I think there was an aspiration for that to sound that heavy. I don't know because I wasn't in his mind, but this is what I've read. And Killdozer are not a pop band in any way, shape, or form.
Got it. All right. So they record most of the record, or like how far into the record are they when they get the deal?
Yeah. A lot of the songs are on here, In Bloom, Poly, Breed, Lithium, Dive. They end up, I think, re-recording it because Dave Grohl is on the album. This is Chad Channing still. But yeah, they have most of the songs. Kurt's already written them. They're on this demo.
Right. And then Kim Gordon is part of getting them their deal at Geffen, I was reading.
I think so, yeah, because they had sort of befriended Sonic Youth. I know Mudhoney was close with Sonic Youth, and Sonic Youth was already on Geffen. And I think that also helped Kurt want to go to Geffen because he admired Sonic Youth. Dave Grohl comes into the picture. So they fire Chad Channing. Basically, after these sessions with Butch Vig, they're like, you're not good enough. Chad Channing says he quit. He always says that it was the Kurt and Chris show, and they basically like told him what drum parts to play. He couldn't be creative. It's the same reason Jason Everman, who was in the band for 5 minutes, which we mentioned, he also quit. Slash was fired on the first tour.
Right.
They need a drummer. Dave Grohl was in a hardcore band. Dave Grohl is from the DC area. He was in a hardcore band called Scream as like a 17-year-old. He was hugely obsessed with the Melvins. Sends the Melvins a postcard. He's like, can you guys come to the Scream show in San Francisco? Come to find out, the Scream is actually playing with the Melvins in San Francisco. Also, just fun little tid because I'm obsessed with it. The Melvins moved to San Francisco because Buzz Osborne started dating Shirley Temple's daughter.
What?
And moved into Shirley Temple's house.
Oh, yeah.
Real fact.
Wow.
Anyways, so they're in San Francisco. They play this show. Chris and Kurt are there backstage and they see the show and they're like, this drummer is fucking amazing. And they had loved Dale Crover playing with them because Dale Crover hits super hard and Dave hits super hard. And so there's a few things that happen, but basically they ask him to be in the band and he says yes.
Right. So he's the final linchpin in the whole story here.
Yeah.
How good is this episode? It's good, right? Well, great news, because if you like what you're hearing here, you're going to love what we're doing over on our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, where for $5 a month, you'll get bonus episodes of our show weekly. You heard that right. Every single week, we're dropping more of the same searing, in-depth combos you love about all your most anticipated new albums by stars like Ariana Grande, Dua Lipa, and Tate McRae, just to name a few, parsing apart all the newest pop singles in our famous new music speed rounds, and of course, diving deep on your favorite classic albums like Madonna's Hard Candy, Christina Aguilera's Stripped, and so much more, all with your favorite Pop Pantheon guests. All this, plus you'll get access to our Discord channel, input on future episodes of the show, and so much more. So sign up at the icon tier now at patreon.com/poppantheon or simply by clicking the link in the show notes of this episode. You won't regret it. So there's a lot of tales that are spun about what happens next with this recording process, because basically there's mixes of these songs. Butch Vig wants Kurt to do overdubs, but Kurt doesn't want to do overdubs and has to be sort of talked into it by being told that John Lennon did overdubs.
Yeah, he doesn't want to like double the guitars.
Yes. Basically things that would make the record sound more radio friendly, right? I mean, these are the things that he's resisting more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also a ton of controversy about the mixing of the record, right? Can you talk a little bit about that whole story?
Yeah. Butch Vig presented his own mixes and he and Kurt was like, I don't like these. They're too slick or whatever. So then Geffen was like, okay, let's get someone in to mix them. And they presented a couple people like Scott Litt, who had done REM, Ed Stasium, who had worked with the Ramones and the Smithereens. Famously, Kurt Cobain was obsessed with listening to the Smithereens before he made Nevermind. Also a band called Celtic Frost, who's a total metal band. Anyways, Kurt's like, no. Because he didn't want to bring in, I guess, someone well known. I'm not really sure why. And they're like, let's bring in Andy Wallace because he co-produced the Slayer album, Seasons in the Abyss. And they liked the Slayer album because they were heavy.
Being heavy seems like a real guiding force here.
That was their whole thing. They wanted to sound heavy. According to both Andy Wallace and Butch Vig, when they played the mixes for Kurt, he loved them. But then afterwards, he said that he hated them.
Right. And really what the mixes did was make them sound shinier, right? I mean, they made them sound more radio friendly.
Yeah. I guess. This is a one thing where I am a total dumb bitch. I don't have an ear for this kind of stuff. Like, I'm like, it sounds fine to me. I don't know. Like,
kind of me neither. But apparently this was like such a huge fucking deal when you read about this record, though. Like, this whole controversy.
Well, because it was a whole story.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I feel like Butch Vig was like, oh, I feel like he said he hated it because he had to not want the band to sound radio friendly when he actually liked it to sound radio friendly.
Right. So the record comes out. I mean, I guess maybe we should talk about Smells Like Teen Spirit first, maybe before we talk about the rest of the album.
Yeah.
So basically the record comes out probably inauspiciously.
Well, Smells Like Teen Spirit is released 2 weeks prior to the album.
Right.
September 10th, I think. They make a video for it that comes out with the single. They service this to MTV. MTV at the time was probably not going to play it. It comes out around the same time as the Guns N' Roses Don't Cry video. So there's a woman named Amy Finnerty who was at MTV at the time. And she basically went to the programming people and she was like, listen, I love my job here, but what you guys play on MTV right now does not reflect what me and my generation are like and what we love. Mm. This video from Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, really does. And if you don't play this, I'm going to quit. Basically, she like really fucking rode hard for it and they put it into rotation. And that basically is what starts the trajectory of Nevermind.
Oh, interesting.
You couldn't make it without MTV at this time.
Right. And I want to go back to the video because it's obviously one of the most iconic of the period. But how would you describe this song? I mean, to me, this song sounds pretty radically different than Bleach in many ways. I mean, it is such an obvious pop record. I mean, Kurt literally is quoted as saying about this song, I was trying to write the ultimate pop song. This is the introduction of so many elements that we now associate with Nirvana, including like the loud, soft, loud dynamic. That has also come to become a really standard issue part of pop music. I mean, this is something that Max Martin uses in Katy Perry songs.
And it's all the Pixies who invented this. You know, when I listen to it and I hear Kurt had a really hard time on tour, there's stories of him being like, I can't do this. They want me to be a fucking trained monkey on stage, blah, blah, blah. There's a point in the European tour, I think prior to Nevermind, where he starts to realize some of the fan base that's showing up now for these grunge bands are the same dudes he hated in high school. This starts to happen for all of these bands. And Here We Are Now, Entertain Us, I feel is reflective of standing in front of those people that he felt were like, here we are now, fucking entertain us, you know? It's a song about anger. It's a song about disillusionment. Right. And to your point, it is a pop song.
Right.
It has that undeniable riff and it has the loud, quiet, loud, and it's a pop song.
Right.
It's just produced and sung differently than a regular pop song.
Yeah, it's almost like the nonsensicalness of it feels like a middle finger in a sense. I think about the lyrics, a mulatto, an albino, a mosquito. Like, what is he even talking about?
If you wanted to read into it, you could, like, we don't really say mulatto anymore, but a mulatto, an albino, these are sort of outsider, rejected types of people. My libido, Kurt Cobain famously, sex positive. But at the same time, yeah, you're right. It's a little punk for him to just be like, this doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. There's a lot of melodrama in it to me as well. The sort of loud, soft, loud dynamic speaks to like a drama. There's a sense of almost operatic melodrama to me to this song. Like the way that it explodes in the chorus and then sort of retracts almost like in an extraordinary way. It's the polar opposite feeling. It's almost like three songs in one or something like that. And that's like a really dynamic part of the listening to it, I think.
Yeah. Well, what the quiet loud does is it makes the loud hit hard, right? It makes it hit you in the fucking chest because it's preceded by this soft quiet. It's a genius way to write songs that you want to be emotionally effective.
Yes, and it makes the chorus very surprising when it happens. Like it goes from being kind of tender to being pummeling on the turn of a dime, and it makes the listen thrilling, you know, and it adds a real sense of rush to listening to it. And this song just like makes you want to break shit. That's yeah. The number one sensation that I feel like you walk away from it with. It's just, you just want to like throw your head through a wall. And I feel like that must have been a feeling that was very provocative and speaking to a lot of feelings of anger. angst and agita, because as you mentioned, this song just blows up into like the biggest thing ever. I do want to talk about the video. I mean, the video is really interesting because it's them lit from underneath in a high school gym, essentially just performing the song. Why was the video such a powerful reflection of the song, and why do you think it caught on it like it did?
I think there's the theme of it's like a high school pep rally, and like the most demonic high school probably really resonated with teenagers to see this.
Right.
Seeing high school and pep rally and stuff presented in the way that maybe they saw it, which was like fucking hell and misery and just shit with those anarchy cheerleaders.
Right.
And the sort of sepia tonedness of the whole thing, which you didn't see videos like that. Yeah, it was just something brand new.
Right. They look scary and menacing in that underlit sort of feeling. I felt like when I watched that video, I think the fact that it takes place in like the most platonic ideal of Americana, like the high school gym, the pep rally, and they're standing there, it's almost like, hi, we are the new generation. This is the new cultural movement. It's a statement on the arrival of an entire new attitude or something like that.
Yeah. And remember that they're like wearing plain ass thrift store clothes. Their hair is long and dirty. It's not stuff you saw on MTV. It was very much all Guns N' Roses and Whitney Houston.
Right.
And even metal bands were more polished than that. Even Metallica was more polished than that, you know?
What about the rest of this record? I mean, I know there's a series of songs that are classics on this record, from In Bloom to Come As You Are to Lithium. What are the rest of these songs doing that is in conversation with Smells Like Teen Spirit? We could talk about each of them if you want. I mean, In Bloom to me is one of the poppiest of the pop songs on here and is really funny because it's almost about the notion of selling out. It's got this big sing-songy chorus and it's kind of like an indictment, kind of like Smells Like Teen Spirit, about who the audience of Nirvana was becoming as they continued to get bigger, essentially.
Exactly. Smells Like Teen Spirit's one of the hardest ones on here, tonally.
Yeah.
But you get back into the other ones, like you get into In Bloom, Drain You, which is one of my favorite songs, which is like a straight up just poppy love song.
Right.
He's such a good songwriter. Or Breed, which is a sped up pop song.
Right. Almost like Red Hot Chili Peppers knocking at their door a little bit. That level of pop crossover.
Kurt is rolling over in his grave. Yeah, and I think you kind of touched on it. A lot of this is, I don't want to say mocking because that's not the right word, but definitely cynical.
Yes.
It's like a cynical read on what Kurt is seeing and experiencing in his own life and also in their career and
right.
through this rise. Again, you have to remember that Nevermind was written before any of this fame, but there was still a growing underground subculture swell that they were benefiting from before this came out.
Right. In Bloom is always like a hilarious song to me because it's the most sing-songy thing of all time, and yet it feels like it's giving the finger to anyone that might enjoy that.
Yeah.
There's a real sense of cynicism and of sinisterness to that.
He knows not what it means, babe. He knows not what it means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that song. And then obviously Come As You Are, which is like another one of the signature songs of this record, is kind of like a ballad that's almost like a little bit psychedelic feel to it, I thought. Come as you are, as you
were, as I want you to be. We talked about authenticity, right? Like if you read this just on the surface, it does a little bit sound just come the way you are, you know? But knowing Kurt, I don't think he would present such a simplistic thing. That's why the lyrics continuously contradict themselves.
Right. It's almost like about the false idea of people wanting you to be yourself. And then I think there's also the sort of danger of the gun reference. Gun guns come up a lot on this record, and I wonder if that's representative of the overarching sense of danger that this group is bringing to pop audiences, like the idea of the gun as a threat, or them as a threat, or their attitude or ideas as threatening, and also Kurt's own threateningness to his own self. I mean, one of the things we haven't totally touched on is that Kurt is already engaged in drugs and is a bit of a dangerous character to himself at this time, and sometimes I perceive the lyrics about the gun as almost inwardly refracted or something like that.
I don't want to speculate on what was going on in terms of self-harm or ideas of self-harm in Kurt's mind, but
right.
I will say, I mean, there's a lot of gun reference on this album, but there's a lot of guns in Aberdeen.
Right.
There's a lot of experiencing guns and gun culture and sort of this masculine redneck society. So like, I've always kind of read it a little bit as a rejection of that gun-toting right-wing. There's actually a really famous story from early on where like Kurt's stepfather, who was the one after the schizophrenic boyfriend, who was a crazy alcoholic, his mother, Wendy, the guy had not come home or whatever, and he comes home the next morning and she threatens him with one of his own shotguns and then packs up all his guns and ammo, and he had a ton, and with Kurt's little sister goes and throws them in the river, and Kurt fished them out and sold them and use the money to buy an amp. Mm. So like, this is someone who's surrounded by this ugly masculine gun culture from a young age, and I'm not really sure it was positive to him.
Yeah, that's really interesting too. And I think a lot of this record is dealing with a lot of the conflict he experienced in his upbringing. I brought up Lithium earlier. I feel like you were talking about guns as part of like Aberdeen culture. Obviously, like, he has this very fraught relationship with religion, and Lithium is kind of like a characterization of religion as vice.
Yeah.
It sort of talks about religion as its own form of addiction.
Yeah, opiate of the masses, as they say.
Yes, exactly. Sunday morning is every day for all I care. And I'm not scared by my candles in our days, cause I found God. Yeah! In a daze because I found God, you know. I think that that's one of the most powerful moments on this record for me, and also really interesting because I was just thinking about him, and I didn't realize this before I was researching for this episode, that he had his own sort of experience with religion as an opioid of his own life.
Yeah, with the born again family.
Yes. And I wonder if that's another aspect of this moment, is sort of this generation's relationship to religion in general. Gen X is sort of being maybe a new level of outward rejection of organized religion. I wonder if that was like another part of the culture that this was speaking to a little bit.
I think so, for sure. I mean, Gen X is the generation that started really pushing for pro-choice, mm-hmm. and all this stuff that they had dealt with, the oppressive parts of organized religion, even the divorcing that we talked about earlier. Like, part of the reason there wasn't divorce earlier on was because it was almost impossible for women to get divorced and have any sort of life. They couldn't have credit cards, couldn't have bank accounts. And while we talked about the divorce sort of traumatizing a generation of kids, the suicide rate in women went down a lot as the divorce rate went up, you know?
Yeah.
So... a lot of layers. And also, I wanted to like just touch on territorial pissings.
Yes.
Which Kurt, kind of an early, obviously feminist, but also like talking about the mistreatment of Native American people. And the brilliance, I think, of this song is that intro that Chris sings, which is, come on, people now, smile on your brother. Mm. Everybody get together, try and love one another, which is from this 60s hippie baby boomer anthem that they really felt swindled by. The 60s counterculture, like, we just all love each other. We just sit in. Summer of Love. Actually, it didn't work. It didn't fix anything.
Yes, right. I feel like that's a big part of Gen X culture, actually, now that you're talking about it, is the sort of lack of fulfillment of the hippie generation, or sort of a cynicism or eye roll at that optimism. Sort of like, hey, look what you've actually left us with. Because a lot of those hippies went on to be the people of the excess 80s that you were speaking about earlier. Like, a lot of those hippies grew up to be exactly what they were against in all of that culture. And I think so much of the attitude, this sort of sarcastic eye roll, disaffected, and all the anger and all the things we've been talking about that is channeled through this music generation here is kind of like an exposure of the emptiness of the platitudes of that era. Then that feels like an underpinning of a lot of this as well. I really love all your points about Kurt as a feminist. And another song that I wanted to bring up is Polly, which is a really disturbing song that's told from the perspective of a guy that basically like kidnaps and rapes a woman.
Yeah.
What a... Isn't me, have a seed, let me clip dirty wings, let me take a ride, cut yourself, want some help,
please myself.
It's a song that is an indictment of male sexuality and aggression.
100%. I mean, he is taking on a character to show how ugly it is, to diminish it. I mean, it's similar. Sorry, I keep bringing up Pearl Jam. I think you just can't, in terms of pop culture and these bands, not bring them up because they have a lot of counterpoints, even though they're extremely different bands. But Jeremy is also told from the perspective of the abuser.
Yes, that's so true.
This was a really powerful way to get a message across. I do know that Kurt talked so much about being frustrated by the stupidity and narrow-mindedness of people.
Right.
I have to assume that underpinning a lot of this music is the desire to get people to fucking think.
Right. And not spoon-feed these ideas to people either. It's not like, give peace a chance.
Yes, exactly. It's like, use your brain and try to figure out what I'm trying to say to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think the last song that I just want to make sure that we talk about is Something in the Way, which is maybe the most overtly beautiful song on this record. I mean, this is almost like a lullaby in some ways, a haunting lullaby. Yeah. Led by a cello. It references a moment in his life where he mythologically lived under a bridge, apparently, for a period of time, although that's been, I think, challenged.
Which he did not, right? I think people should be able to make their own myth, you know?
I agree. Myth making is an American pastime.
Yeah.
The thing that I like about this song is it's the most unvarnished, because it's so underdressed in a good way, of just what a beautiful songwriter he was without needing to have any of the other stuff on top of it necessarily. The stripped downness just reveals what a powerful singer he is and what a powerful songwriter he is in its most plain way, I think, on this record. I just think this is a beautiful song.
Especially in the unplugged version. It's really hits hard.
All right. So this record, it would be hard to understate what a sensation this grows into. It becomes massively, massively successful. It goes diamond in the US.
Yeah.
And turns Nirvana into major, major superstars, as you were mentioning, beyond anything that they could have anticipated coming into
yeah.
this. I have two questions. One is, how does this impact the rock and pop scene? How does the success of this record shift what's happening in mainstream music culture?
You can see it. So many copycat bands start popping up, but also so many guitar rock bands. What do they call it? The year that punk broke, right? 1991, the year that punk broke. Next thing you know, there are A&Rs of every fucking label crawling these clubs and signing any band with a fucking guitar,
right,
trying
right.
to capitalize on this. Also, grunge becomes a commodity. It becomes packaged and resold to people within seconds. The Seattle sound is like a sticker that's slapped on all these CDs. They take as quickly as they can to sell it. And also, I think other bands clearly benefited. The rising tide brings up all the boats or whatever. I don't think that's the saying, but you know.
That's close enough.
I'm ESL, so stick with me. Then you start to see the programming on MTV like really change. Now you're seeing Pearl Jam videos, Soundgarden videos, Alice in Chains videos. It really shifts things, and really quickly. I mean, Nevermind came out in September. By, I think it's January. I think the Christmas sales of Nevermind as gifts push it to number one. They knock Michael Jackson off number one on the Billboard album chart.
Which is poetic.
It's insane. Yeah, it couldn't be more metaphorical, right?
Right. That poeticism of them knocking Michael Jackson out of the number one spot. And Michael Jackson is the most plainly global, dominating, that's my ambition, that's what I'm here for, pop star of all time. So it's interesting to see a band that's sort of outwardly facing, or at least in terms of their image, is sort of going like, hey, how did we get here? We don't even want this level of success. I find that interesting. What is Kurt's relationship to this success? One thing, again, that we haven't threaded through is Kurt is struggling with drug addiction at this moment, right? I mean, he is dealing with a lot of personal struggle through this moment. I'm curious, what's going on with them as a band? What's going on with him, and how are they relating to this superstardom?
I don't think well. I mean, I think it's hard to overstate how incredibly difficult it must have been, because people love to just be like, well, they're ungrateful. Imagine the thing of lottery winners. You know this famous curse of winning the lottery, right?
Right.
Where they go back to like what happens to these people, and it's always disastrous and miserable. Like no one benefits benefits from having their life completely 180'd essentially overnight. I mean, I think within a year is overnight. You go from like playing clubs and having your friends and your scene to you can't even walk in the streets, and that hundreds of thousands of kids are sending you letters that only you understand them and wanting so much from you, and you barely can keep it together yourself. I can't imagine how hard that must have been.
I think it's just particularly hard in the instance of a group that is concerned with notions of like integrity, authenticity, and selling out. I think that would be hard for anybody, but it's a certain version of hardness for a Michael Jackson or something like that. And it's different for a group that is, you can tell in the way that the next record pans out that this is something that they felt not only was the level of fame probably oppressive, but that becoming known or becoming beholden to so many people felt like it was a threat to Kurt's integrity.
Of course, you grow up hating jocks and normies who fucking pick on you, and then you open your eyes and they're all standing in front of you buying your CD at your shows. It's a mind fuck, and it's not going to make you that happy. I always find it really interesting though. I don't know why. I wasn't there. I'm not in his head, not in their heads, but they could have made different choices that might have slowed the ascent. Again, I hate to keep bringing up Pearl Jam, but because it's a really good amalgam or whatever of the different ways and completely different people, very different music, similar ascent, similar overnight success, similar front men who were very concerned with integrity, with being authentic. And what Pearl Jam did was they stopped making videos. After the first album, they didn't make another video for 6 years. And it cost them probably, but they purposely tried to slam the brakes as much as they could on their own career. I mean, some things were out of their control and some were. And ultimately, I think it saved them as a band. It's why they're still a band. Whereas it's always interesting to me that it clearly was really miserable, but they went ahead and made In Utero, and they went ahead and made more albums. They kept touring. There was always the option to stop. Not that it's that easy. I'm not blaming. I'm just saying, like,
no, it's not that easy. And also, they wanted it. He wanted it too. I mean, another thing that happens in the post Nevermind Success era is that they get into an intra-band fight over the royalties of the songs. It's not as if they're just sort of like this altruistic socialist ideal of...
Well, yeah, they're not crass.
No.
Okay, they're a normal band who wants to have their money and wants to be successful. They just maybe didn't want to be pop stars.
Right. What role does the Courtney Love of it all start to play in the fame? I mean, at a certain point, Kurt also becomes part of like a massive celebrity couple, which is another part of this.
Yeah. I mean, they were completely in love and soulmates, and it's really beautiful. But as far as the press is concerned, it made everything 1,000 times worse because they were so ugly and vicious to them. And I think it really fucking tore Kurt apart to see this stuff and have these accusations flung. And never forget the fucking disgusting Vanity Fair article that said that Courtney was using heroin when she was pregnant and they got CPS called on them. It was just vultures, ugly, disgusting media vultures, all this added stress. I mean, imagine you're dealing with this fame and stuff and your own problems, and then CPS shows up at your door to take your fucking kid away because of a very irresponsible, borderline untruthful Vanity Fair article.
And also there's the whole sexism of Courtney as the Yoko of her generation. I mean,
even fucking get me started, babe.
But the band is not in a great place with one another following the success of this, from my understanding.
From what I understand, yeah. I don't know too much of the ins and outs in it, but also what band would be? How do you deal with that? The fact that any band stays together is a miracle, because that is like a marriage times a million, and all of these pressures come in and everyone starts to feel their own type of way. It's intense.
100%. All right. So how does all of this affect their third and final studio album, In Utero, which eventually comes out in 1993 and I think is in many ways reactionary to what happened with Nevermind? What changes here in approach, and how does this music react in some ways to their success?
Yeah. Tell me what you think, because like I feel like you have a strong idea of what you mean by reactionary.
Because I think A, they record the record very differently. They go to Steve Albini and he speaks more to Kurt's anti-establishment mentality, I think, than Butch Vig does. They record the record at his house in the middle of fucking nowhere, like in his kitchen. They don't want the record to sound polished. They don't want the album to have the sleek polish of Nevermind. There was a lot of press at this time, and I was reading it over and over again, of Kurt and band talking about how much they hated Nevermind. They hated how it sounded. They hated the mixes of it.
Right.
They felt like it was a mark against them in many ways. And so it feels like to me that until the record label stepped in at a later period and had them remix some of the songs for radio, which is not something that they had originally intended to do, it feels like they were very much hoping to like shore up their cred with this music. They could have easily gone in an opposite direction after Nevermind and made a more poppy record, or made a record that was as polished as Nevermind was. I mean, there was plenty of directions. They could have done anything they wanted to, obviously, after this album.
Yeah.
They opened the record with a song called Serve the Servants, which is clearly like an indictment of their fame. It seems obvious to me that this record is at least trying to telegraph to us that they are like, fuck everything that just happened to us. Do you not see it that way?
No, of course. Listen, what are you going to write about when it's time to make your third album and this is your life? You're going to write about your feelings about what you're experiencing. So that makes perfect sense to me. The Albini of it all makes a ton of sense to me. Don't forget that Kurt was a huge PJ Harvey fan.
Right.
And he really loved Rid of Me that Albini produced and wanted that same vocal tone. But I find that he leans even further into the pop music writing sensibility. He didn't try to make the music inaccessible. In my estimation, again, purely speculative fanfic, I see an artist who just continually grows more confident in, at the very least, what they want. Kurt was a control freak.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it in the story of the video. He ended up coming in and re-editing it with the editor. And he said it about the Pixies, where like he had these songs early on that sounded like Nevermind songs, but he was too scared to put them out. Then he got some confidence because he heard the Pixies. So Nevermind, he does this. He has to do it with Butch Vig. Maybe he doesn't like the mix. Now he has confidence and he has power, so he can do whatever he wants. Mm. And he's like, yeah, I want Steve Albini. I want that kind of sound. There's also a moment where I think he said he might have gone back to Jack Endino, and thank God he didn't. No offense to Jack Endino, love and respect, but we would not have what we have, which is, you know, arguably a better album than Nevermind.
Well, the thing is that's interesting is if this is what his life is about now, it's a bleak fucking album. I mean, this album is very sad to me.
Well, yeah, babe, have you heard? I'm sorry that I can't bring up Pearl Jam, but also comes out in 93 is Versus. Same thing. They're dealing with very similar things in life and they're channeling them into their music and they're angry and they're fucking disillusioned. It's not navel gazing per se, but you're going to write about your experience and they are not having a good time. It is not fun. It is not enjoyable. They are fucking mad and they feel that they have become commodities that are being exploited and they write about it.
Mm.
And also Kurt's fallen in love. So there's many songs on here that are about Courtney.
Right. And I just think not everyone would react to success with this level of anger necessarily.
Yeah.
That's very specific to this particular band's ethos, to Kurt's attitudes about success and about capitalism and to this movement in general that is kind of anti-establishment and now is the establishment. And I feel like there is a lot of multiple pulls on Kurt to like both be who he is as an artist, which does have pop sensibility to it in some ways, but also to make sure that he telegraphs to everybody that he's not bought into what's happened to them.
Yeah, and he wasn't. He's not bought into the grunge fashion spread in Vogue. He's
right.
Not bought into like the $6,000 grunge dress they're trying to sell you. You know, he's not bought into like the commodification of their just look and life. It disgusted him, as it would anyone, I think.
Yes. One of the most interesting themes to me on this record is the body horror stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, one of the big singles is called Heart-Shaped Box. I wouldn't necessarily say that's a body horror song, but it's a song that he wrote about children having cancer. But there's a bunch of songs that deal with talking about various organs, and that was just one thing that jumped out to me as an interesting sort of motif on this record. I'm curious, what do you think is happening in terms of sound and in terms of lyrical and thematic content? I mean, you talked about love songs. What are examples of some of the love songs? What are examples to you of some of the songs that are disaffected by what's happened to them?
I think it's largely a song about Courtney Love. She eyes me like a Pisces when I am weak, but I can see the I'll eat your cancer when I'm turned black. I mean, Rape Me is to me so clearly anti-capitalist.
Yes, of course. And famously, he was asked not to sing it on the VMAs and then did.
Yes.
Yes.
He was like, sure, no, I totally won't. Anyways, here we go. The song's All Right Me. All Apologies is an incredible song. I do want to point out that it's been talked about a lot, but Kurt Cobain had myriad health problems. Besides his obvious predilection for heroin, he had like unbearable digestion and stomach issues for years and years and years and years. So I wonder if some of that body horror that you're hearing is perhaps being concerned with his own health and deteriorating wellness. I don't know.
He talked about taking heroin to deal with that pain, but apparently that made it worse, which is not surprising because heroin usually doesn't help your health.
Well, I'm not a doctor, so can't really I can't speak to that, but yeah, not really like a wellness. They don't sell it at Erewhon. What if they did? Heroin smoothie. If this was 1994 and it was like Erewhon smoothies, would they make like a Kurt Cobain heroin smoothie? That would be so dark, so disgusting.
The Kurt Cobain smoothie at Erewhon.
I love the line in All Apologies that everyone is gay. So good.
Yes. I love that song too. It almost sounds REM-esque to me, which I think Kurt would probably hate, but that is something that came across my radar when I was listening to it.
No, I think he had respect for REM.
You think?
Yeah. Michael Cyprys Francis's godfather. I mean, REM is an incredible band. He loved that level of songwriting. I think he did like REM for sure. Mm. REM invented indie rock, you know? They're very important.
What was the reaction to this album, like as it pertains to Nevermind? Did it have the effect that Kurt wanted it to? Like, what do you think was the reaction to like the casual fans they had picked up from Nevermind to this music?
I think they were like literally singing along to I Wish I Was Like You, Easily Amused, not even thinking that this is about you. Mm. It did not slow down the fandom.
It wasn't as massively successful out the gate, though, as Nevermind was.
You said it earlier, grunge was very short. The tenure of grunge was maybe 3 years. By 94, it was being supplanted by Green Day and Weezer and brighter, poppier stuff.
So in some ways, this record doing not as well as Nevermind initially before Kurt Cobain died was already a sense of a changing tide in rock music and pop music at this moment.
I think so. I mean, depends though. Like Versus outsold 10, so I don't know. But a bit of a different vibe, different energy.
So I want to talk a little bit about the end of Kurt's life. So obviously they do, after this, record a very legendary MTV Unplugged album, which is really beautiful.
God, I really wish I remember who said this. I think it was Stephen Hayden, but he said that because it came out after he died, it has the like eerie quality of a man hosting his own wake.
Yes, I can hear that.
Even like the visuals of it, it really was so chilling to see after the fact. Mm. One of the most iconic MTV Unplugs of all time. I will say something. The fact that he used that platform to play two Meat Puppets songs, because he was a huge Meat Puppets fan, is so fucking cool. Just using that to make money from just having those two songs on there.
Right. And also he notably like doesn't do Smells Like Teen Spirit. I mean, there's that anti-establishment streak.
Totally.
So what do you know about the end of his life? I mean, Kurt is very addicted to heroin at the end of his life. It's having a massive effect on the In Utero tour. He's very erratic on that tour. And it's obviously become very controversial. But in 1994, as far as we know, he ends up dying by suicide, mm-hmm. by gunshot wound to the head. What's the public reaction to that? What does that represent? What is that moment about in your mind?
Well, I can speak for myself.
Yes.
It's definitely my, where were you when John Lennon died of our parents? You know, like,
yes.
I'll never forget that day. I can't explain totally why, but hearing that anger in Nevermind, which obviously is the first Nirvana album I heard because I was not an extremely precocious 9-year-old who knew about Bleach and Sub Pop, but
yes.
Was so important to hear this anger reflected back and to be able to express through it. But yeah, I mean, it broke my heart. It also, for me anyways, it was like, damn, we just had a thing and now it's taken away, you know, like we don't get to have this thing anymore. Mm. Like, and maybe it even speaks to the pressure he must have felt, but you felt reflected by this person in culture and then they were just gone. And it did do a thing to enshrine that band and that legacy in Amber. Mm. You can always see that for legacy and career, it's the best thing to happen, but it's the worst thing possible to happen, right?
Right. I always link this in my mind, and I know I brought this up earlier, to the deaths of Biggie and Tupac a couple of years later.
Totally.
Because I do think the sort of explosion of Nirvana and the explosion of gangster rap are really tied to each other. They're related, I think, in so many different ways. And it was a moment, I think, where pop music was overtaken by these more dangerous, more expressive subgenres that for a fleeting moment had a vice grip on the center of pop music, then sort of had some of their biggest representatives stomped out. There's something powerful about that image, about the thought of these three people who were so emblematic of that particular moment of pop being infiltrated in some ways by this countercultural movement and then being wiped out 1, 2, 3 is just like a really weirdly horrific sort of like statement on the way that we revert to the mean in some ways. There's a poetic way in which it feels like our culture couldn't handle them and their hold on the center of our mainstream music culture for too long or something like that. Like it had to dispense with them.
Even the opposite, right? They couldn't handle being absorbed by the center. The center crushed them, you know?
Yes, the center crushed them. I think that's a really powerful way to put it. Where would you have liked Kurt or Nirvana to go? Do you ever fantasize about like what this band might have been? Have you ever thought about that?
I honestly don't think they would have made another album.
Right.
You know, you have the so-called grunge big four. Only one made it past the year 2000.
Right.
Only Pearl Jam.
Right.
Soundgarden broke up in like 97 or 98. Alice in Chains never officially broke up, but Layne Staley was like, I choose heroin, bye. And then died, you know, a couple of years later. And you see what happened to rock music anyways, right? It was like, it briefly became Weezer, Green Day, pop punk, Counting Crows, Dave Matthews Band, Hootie and the Blowfish. Then it turned into rap rock and new metal, and then just went away.
Yeah.
And that's it. To survive that and to become a legacy rock act, it was not going to be sustainable, I don't think. Because they weren't going to turn around and make jam touring band music. You kind of have to become dad rock in a sense. And I don't say that disparagingly. But that's what survives. That's why people still go see Pearl Jam year in and year out, fucking 30 years later, because they just drifted more towards the Neil Young of it all and became that. Nirvana was never going to do that. That was never going to happen.
Right. Kurt wouldn't be scoring movies right now, you don't think?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. He's very talented.
Yeah.
He might have been scoring movies, but I don't think there'd be Nirvana making albums.
Yeah.
That's just my 2 cents. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that sounds probably right.
Maybe he would have formed a different band. I really don't know.
Yeah. Or like become like a woodworker or something like that.
Sure, an artist. I mean, he was a visual artist.
Yes.
You never know. But I don't imagine that there would have been much more Nirvana music.
When you look out at music today or celebrity today, I mean, like, do you see Kurt's impact when we look around in popular culture today? Like, are there certain elements of Kurt or this band's impact that register for you?
Oh my God, yeah. Every guy in a band dresses like Kurt Cobain, that's for sure. Like,
right.
A vice grip that Nirvana had.
Yes.
I mean, grunge in general, you're seeing it again now, even though it seems fairly impossible to become a mainstream rock band, and we won't get into why that is, some, you know, lack of monoculture, et cetera, et cetera. But even in the smaller indie bands, they all kind of sound either like a 90s grunge band or like a pop punk band. There's like two things that have endured, and it's these two things.
I often wonder like what Kurt would have thought about so much music that's come after him. Just as someone who had like really good taste, and as much as we've talked about him as someone that was concerned with the ideas of integrity and selling out, like I feel like would have had like a really open mind to a lot of stuff and probably would have gotten into like all kinds of things that have bubbled up after him that whatever, it would be hard to conceive. I just always wonder what he would have been into.
I know. Probably like noise music.
Yes, right.
I don't know. Definitely not Bush, probably.
Not Bush. All right, let's talk about the pop pantheon. I know we touched on this briefly when we were off-miking about this. It's a little bit strange, obviously, to like slot Nirvana into this. A very short-lived period of success and a very short-lived period of real pop crossover success, and yet like an incredibly influential moment of pop cultural success. And as we mentioned, the early death kind of makes it into this situation where he's so larger than life.
Yeah.
The legacy is so humongous. I mean, I don't remember whether you said this on or off mic, but Pearl Jam was probably like a bigger band in than even Nirvana was. But there's no question that to the casual fan, Kurt Cobain is the most famous member of this scene.
Because Kurt Cobain has joined the annals of what I like to call dorm room poster people. And that is Bob Marley. That is Jim Morrison. These are people who died young, who they sell the posters that people hang in their dorm rooms. They're on t-shirts. They sell them at Hot Topic and Head Shops. Tupac is one of those people as well.
Absolutely. But I feel like all of those artists, or most of them, had a chance to make more music than Nirvana did. I mean, like, Bob Marley made a lot of albums.
Yeah.
One of the things that makes Kurt unique, and I think does kind of link him to Amy Winehouse pretty directly in some ways, is that you really were just at the beginning of the music. There's so little that's been left behind. And in some ways, it's made the music so canonized, and it's hard to sort of even think about it outside of knowing that it was all that there was. Like, I think about that with Back to Black so much. We now revere that record like it is a diamond. I wonder, like, how we would have thought about it if it was just the first in a run of a lot of albums from her.
Right.
Would it be held up on the same level that it is if it wasn't the only thing that we have? I think Nevermind is different just because it was such a cultural phenomenon, and it's kind of hard to compare anything to that level of cultural phenomenon. I guess we have to incorporate the idea that he is a legend because of that early death. Like, no matter what, he's legendary.
I mean, he is a legend, but like, I mean, Live Through This by Hole is a better album. There are a lot of better albums than Nevermind. I'm not trying to disparage Nevermind. It's a good...
Yes.
album, and it was important for what it did.
Right.
But as a piece of art, it's not at that level that a lot of these other albums are.
Mm. I think they're in tier three. It's, again, a weird comparison because we haven't done so many acts like them, so it's so hard to be like, let's compare Nirvana to Katy Perry.
Where would Garth Brooks go?
I think Garth Brooks would go in...
Garth Brooks should be tier two, at least.
I would agree.
You forget that Garth Brooks was one of the highest-selling artists of the entire 90s.
Huge!
Every year had a top one or top two album. Massive, massive artist.
Yes, I think probably tier two. So what does that make you think Nirvana belongs in? Three?
Yeah, it feels like to me three is where the dorm room posters go.
Yes, I agree.
That's where you would probably put Jim Morrison and the Doors.
Yes.
So I think probably it makes sense.
All right, so let's put them in tier three. I have one last question for you, which is, what is an underrated Nirvana song? Maybe something we have not spent a ton of time on that we could send the show out on.
Oh my God. Yes. I'm a huge Incesticide fan, which was the album of B-sides, basically, that they had to put out when they wouldn't finish In Utero in time.
Yes.
I love Sliver is one of the best Nirvana songs. Aneurysm is one of the best Nirvana songs. We didn't even talk about his love and fascination with the Pastels and all these sort of twee British bands. But yeah, I'll say Aneurysm. I love Aneurysm.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's go out on Aneurysm. Yasi Salik, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was super fun.
All right, so there you have it. Pop Pantheon Nirvana, certified in tier three. The judgment is rendered. I want to say thank you so much to the fabulous Yasi Salik for being such a wonderful guest. I want to thank Russ Martin for everything he does to make this show happen every week, to PJ Vernietti for his help editing this episode, and to Alex Lobo for her help with the artwork. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Pop Pantheon wherever you're listening to it now. Social media is at Pop Pantheon Pod. I'm at DJ LOUIEXIV. Merch at poppantheonpod.com. Patreon at patreon.com/poppantheon for weekly bonus episodes and so much more. Gorgeous Gorgeous on Saturday night in Los Angeles at Los Globos, and on May 10th at the Sultan Room in Bushwick. And Taylor Mania, our Pop Pantheon dance party, is tomorrow night at Parkside Lounge in the East Village. Get tickets in the show notes of this episode for all of that stuff. And until we meet again, have a wonderful life. Oh, and I hope to see you guys at the live show. Oh my God, our live show on Monday. Hope to see you guys there. Hope to see you at Taylor Mania. Anyway, have a wonderful life. Bye-bye. Bye.